Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brennan McCombe.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the electronic Charles.
Well, spring is struggling through here, Professor McConville. Do you feel that?
I do.
I'm watching spring, the buds of the trees.
The spring is having a midlife crisis.
Yeah, the spring, it tried to spring a couple of weeks ago, and then it got slapped back by late winter. Late winter just came in and just did that thing with the back of its hand to spring. And spring snuck back into its hole, its groundhog hole, and has been afraid to come out since.
Spring is having a crisis. Spring feels unwelcomed.
Yeah, but I'm enjoying seeing the trees trying to bud, and I haven't fished yet, man. I mean, this is bad. I got flooded out. My fishing trip got flooded out.
That's what I can't believe. It's already the middle of May, and you have yet to torment a trout.
I have not caught a trout. This has got to stop. So, all right. Well, I will salve my sadness with pork, and I will have for breakfast. I will have bacon and sausage, two eggs over easy. And I think I actually will have three pieces of rye toast today, just to taunt you, because I know you're not doing many carbs, and I'm going to slather my rye toast with Kerrygold Irish butter.
Just to torment me.
Just to torment you.
So basically what we're talking about is double swine,
yes.
Swine, avian, and some carbs, super
yep.
carbs.
Double swine, extra carbs, please.
Right. I've been eating a lot of bacon lately, and I actually had a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich for dinner the other night.
Ooh,
which was
one of my favorites.
Yeah, delicious.
Do you like the bacon crispy, or do you like it soft?
I like a crispy bacon. I don't like a soft bacon.
Me too.
I like a crispy bacon, and I am going to have some bacon. I'm going to have a small bowl of granola.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have a little Danish Havarti cheese. Yum.
Okay, all right. Man, if you ever had an egg with that bacon, you would know how those two things were really meant to go together. But
if I ever had an egg, then that would happen.
But
I'm
not going to. It's because you're just this perverse person who won't, you know, eat like a normal human being. But the granola thing, yeah, okay, I get it. No grapes today. I'm kind of glad about that. Yeah.
No grapes today.
Yeah. So on your BLT.
Yes.
What do you use as the spread, the condiment?
Oh, I don't put a condiment on it at all.
Are you kidding?
I do not. I don't put, like, I'm not a Southerner. I don't put mayonnaise on everything.
I don't put mayonnaise on everything, but I put it on a BLT.
Yeah, I know, because you're a Southerner.
No, because any human being puts mayonnaise on a BLT. Okay, that's
a Southern human being would do that.
Wrong.
No. Here's what I do, listeners. I usually toast the bread only on one side. I get my bacon, lettuce, and tomato, and then I make the sandwich, and then I put a tiny sprinkle of balsamic vinegar on top of the sandwich, and then I cut it. And it makes a delicious kind of...
You put it on top of the sandwich?
Yeah, in other words, not on top of the bread.
You put your spread on the outside of the sandwich, and you toast only one side. And you want to claim that I'm the weirdo.
It's okay. Not a spread. It's balsamic. I don't use a spread.
It's a condiment. My gosh. You put it on the outside of the sandwich. Do you put your peanut butter and jelly on the outside of the sandwich too?
I haven't had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Okay, you're impossible. There's no discussing food with him, listener. You can't win. Oh gosh, I'm going to need an extra iced coffee today.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to do part two of our series on archaic or pre-classical Greece, the early Greece that most people don't know much about. If you're willing to continue along that line, this all depends on your, you know, you have veto power, of course.
I'm excited about this, and I got some excellent feedback. People, as I told you, were happy to get out of Ireland. But, you know, they'd gotten depressed after seven episodes, even though it was accurate what we said. You know, it was an accurate, I'm not an expert on Irish history, but it was, you know, it was a meaningful arc in terms of what had happened there. Certainly. It was so complex and so, you know, dramatic. But people have commented on the chariots and the sort of happy. And as I said, once your culture is being destroyed from thousands of years away, it seems so much more entertaining, you know?
All right, good. All right, well, we'll do it then. We will do part two of archaic or pre-classical Greece. I want to start out by sort of setting the table. We're gonna destroy the Mycenaean Greek world today. Okay, that's actually the subject, the collapse of the Mycenaean Greek world.
Can I ask you something before we begin? Because this came up in several people emailed me about the episode. What is the exact geography of Mycenaean Greece?
How would you define it? Yeah. Perfect way. Great segue. Thank you, listeners.
Listener.
Thank you, listener. So if we think about the settlements that have been excavated for the Mycenaean Greek world, that is where we know they were living between about 1600 and about 1200 or 1150 BC. You want to think of the southern Greek peninsula, okay? Mm-hmm. Especially the Peloponnese, which is the southernmost part of the Greek peninsula.
Right.
Central Greece, what is today, or what was in antiquity, the area of Boeotia, where Thebes is. Attiki, or Attica, where Athens is. So that takes in all of central, basically all of central and southern Greece. So the extent of the northernness of the Mycenaean culture is not quite clear. But Mount Olympus, of course, plays a very important role in the conception of the religious world, and that's the same religious world, and that's in Thessaly, so that's quite far north. So it's quite clear they had occupied much of, if not all, of the Balkan Peninsula and many of the islands, including Crete. So there are Mycenaean settlements all over the islands and the island of Crete as well.
What about Ionia? In other words, what's now the coast of Turkey and in Greece, you know?
Yes. There were settlements there that were almost certainly Mycenaean Greek. And Miletus, for example, may have been a Greek settlement. I'm not as up on the Greek remains. The Greek remains of Ionia are basically later, okay? As we're going to talk about in this episode, we know that the Greeks colonized those areas after the Mycenaean world. We're quite sure they were trading with those areas during the Mycenaean world. But whether there was actually a Mycenaean settlement in Western Asia Minor, I think is a subject that's open for debate, to the best of my knowledge. So, but the fact that you bring up the geography of this, so it's basically the Greek world as we think of it in the classical period, with the possible exception of not many Greeks in Asia Minor. But the geopolitical situation is what I really wanted to stress as we start today, because you want to think of the Eastern Mediterranean as a unit. Okay, if you take a box and you have the northwestern corner of that box is the Balkans, where Greece is, and then the northeastern corner is Asia Minor, where the Hittites are, and the southeastern corner of that box is Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and the Euphrates River, and the southwestern corner of that box is Egypt. And if you think of it that way, then you will have the basic geography of the people who really mattered in this period, all right, in terms of trade, geopolitics, diplomacy. That's the world that was communicating with each other. And as I said in the last episode, the great kings of these empires essentially wrote letters to each other. They exchanged gifts. They exchanged members of their family. For marriages, when Tutankhamun's widow requested a prince from the Hittites, the Hittite great king sent one of his sons, and he got assassinated. The Egyptians assassinated him, and this created, as you can imagine, a diplomatic crisis.
Do we know why they assassinated him? just because they didn't like him?
They didn't want a Hittite sitting on the throne of Egypt.
Egypt, right.
Whereas this queen needed the support of a strong king.
Right.
You know, so the Hittites and the Egyptians were always lurching back and forth between fairly diplomatic relations to hostile military, you know, engagements. And because the Levant, that stretch of land that essentially is Israel and Palestine and Lebanon today, was the you know, where those two empires met. And so they fought over that territory, which was a quite fertile territory in antiquity, and had the Lebanese, you know, the timber that was there was quite valuable. And
the cedars of Lebanon, the cedars,
exactly.
Yeah.
So, and then you've got the Mesopotamian kingdoms by the Kassites and then the kingdom of Mitanni. But it's just, you've got to imagine a world that's quite cosmopolitan. They tended to correspond with each other in a language called Akkadian, which was a very ancient Mesopotamian language, which followed Sumerians, one of the oldest languages we know of, but it had stuck around as the language of diplomacy into the 14th, 13th, 12th, 11th century and later, in the same way that Latin was used in the Middle Ages. You know, in 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century, when you wanted to communicate between various kingdoms, you didn't use the vernacular language, you used Latin.
Just as you use French in the early modern period, just as you use English right. in the 20th and 21st century.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I was when the Russians conquered France after Napoleon's disaster, I read something recently which said that the emperor of Russia spoke French much better than Napoleon did, who apparently had a thick Corsican accent.
He did have a thick Corsican accent. Yeah.
So that's a funny thing to ponder. But so, okay, these guys are writing to each other, trading with each other. There's a kind of circuit of trade going on in the Eastern Mediterranean where bronze is the thing that everybody needs. Okay. Because all of these kingdoms are based on chariots, as we talked about last time, composite bows, as we talked about last time, and bronze. Bronze for the weapons, essentially, and for defensive armor, et cetera. And there was copper in this area. There's copper on the island of Cyprus, for example. There was copper in other parts of the Near East, in Asia Minor, in the steppes, as we talked about last time. What there wasn't a lot of was, and almost none of, in fact, was tin.
And is this why they open up the trade to Cornwall in England?
Cornwall, right. Yeah. So tin came from far-flung areas. Now, you can actually make bronze. Bronze is of course, made with copper and tin. You can also make it with copper and arsenic. And some of the early bronzes are copper and arsenic. But copper and tin bronze is superior. And we're still trying to figure out exactly where they got all the tin that they needed. Some of it did apparently come from the British Isles, if you can imagine. And there are theories that the Phoenicians were actually circumnavigating the Western, you know, a few centuries later, out of the Strait of Gibraltar, up along the coast of Spain, and making it to the British Isles, even into the Baltic, in fact, one theory holds. But there's trade in any case. And then probably another source of tin was Afghanistan, where there were decent supplies of tin.
Incidentally, in Western Ireland, on the Barrow Peninsula in Cork, there are copper mines there. It's one of the few places in Ireland where there's copper mines, which, of course, that area is exposed. And there's some people who think, you know, most of the copper mines they know of were products of the 19th century. But some people think that there may have been ancient copper mining there early, you know, prehistorically, essentially, in terms of Irish, you know, in other words, going back into this same period. There have been people who speculated on that.
Yeah. Well, the Copper Age, of course, extends well earlier than the Bronze Age, which starts around 3000 BC or so. The alloy of copper and tin comes along after the pure copper weapons that were being used for centuries before that. So, you know, that's certainly more than possible. The point I want to make, is as we're coming up on our first break, the point I really want to emphasize is that these were advanced, at least partially literate societies. That is, the ruling classes, the scribes, these were literate people who knew about the rest of the world, the known world. You know, they weren't localized, thrown in on themselves. It was a very cosmopolitan world in the Eastern Mediterranean about 1250 BC.
With extensive trade networks both into Asia and throughout the Mediterranean and up the coast of Europe to the British Isles.
Exactly.
We're coming up on our first break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Hi, this is Debbie Dedarian Demetriadis from Edgewood Travel. Things are opening up and it's time to go away. Small businesses fuel the economy, and our travel agency in Walpole is ready. Call us now more than ever and forget the internet. Call us at 508-668-2636. Again, 508-668-2636. Edgewood Travel, we make travel easy, and we've got your back. Bon voyage!
This is Mike Janity. Join me every Wednesday afternoon from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for DJ Mike Janity's Disco Dance Party on WNTN.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about the ancient Mediterranean world and what a place it was to be around 1300 or 1250 B.C., Professor McConville. While you could summer on the island of Crete in the beautiful palaces constructed by the Cretans and then occupied by the Mycenaean Greeks, shoot over to Asia Minor and talk to the Hittites, visit Troy on the northwestern coast, one of the greatest, largest cities in this environment before it was destroyed by the Greeks, probably around 1200 BC.
In other words, it was the West Roxbury of the archaic world.
Yes, right. You could shoot down the coast of the Levant and visit the ancient city of Ugarit, which was kind of an independent city-state, very powerful, and managed to maintain its kind of position between the Hittites to the north and the Egyptians to the south. Cruise over to Mesopotamia and talk to the great king there, show him that you know Akkadian and impress him, and then talk and make your way down to Egypt. And see the great pyramids, the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids, and talk to the family of Tutankhamun. And the, Egypt is really at a kind of height, despite the crazy Akhenaten monotheist who ruled there in the 14th century, Amenhotep IV. You've got a very, very vibrant culture all over the Eastern Mediterranean.
Yes, but I'm getting a little concerned because it's sounding a little too idyllic and right. Sort of interesting that something bad is going to happen to right. The entire region.
Yep, that's exactly right. I always tell my students, one thing I can predict with absolute certainty, this civilization will collapse because they all do. And this one that collapsed in the Eastern Mediterranean collapsed in fantastic fashion. You went from the world I just described about 1250 BC to 100 years later, 1150 BC. It's all gone, with the exception of Egypt, which hung on by the skin of its chinny chin chin. The Egyptians just managed to hang on. So what happened? I think the best, there are all kinds of explanations that involve climate, that involve invasions. I think that the best solution to this is that offered by the scholar I mentioned last time, Robert Drews, of Vanderbilt University. He wrote a book called The End of the Bronze Age, The Military Explanation. And what Drews suggests is that all these civilizations were based on chariots, on thousands of chariots and composite bows. That's how you dominated your kingdom. Didn't take that many, actually, as we discussed last time. A big army for this period, a big chariot army, was 1,000, maybe 2,000. Battle of Kadesh between the Hittites and the Egyptians around 1275, probably about 2,000 chariots on each side, okay? Now, there were larger infantries that were used, but the infantry seemed to have been used primarily to protect the chariotry, okay? The chariots are the striking arm of these forces. And if you think about trying to camp with a chariot army, what do you have to do at night? Well, you got to let those horses go. Right, you've got to unhitch them. You have to feed them, fodder them, water them, and they have to be protected. So the main job of the infantry, it seems, at this period was to protect the chariotry when it wasn't up and running, as it were. And of course, you've got to bring along with you, as they apparently did, engineers, people who can fix chariots, they need to be repaired. You've got to bring spare parts. It seems that they stockpiled spare parts in these kingdoms. They may even have made their chariots with parts that were interchangeable. Of course, this is something that comes along in the Industrial Revolution, which makes perfect sense to us, you know, that you should have a wheel that will fit on any chariot, like a tire will almost fit on any car, unless it's a Volkswagen, then you'll have to get a special tire, as I always forget.
Right. But you keep buying Volkswagens.
Somehow I keep making the same mistake.
Did they bring engineers in all seriousness to build bridging for the chariots to cross over to?
Well, I'm sure they did. I can't say that I have any evidence for that.
Right.
But I just would.
It seems logical that they would do so.
They could build palaces that had ramps, et cetera. So I think they had the technology for that. So there also were the special kind of infantrymen that served, and we know about them from the Egyptian records, a special kind of infantrymen that served along with the chariots. That is, during a chariot battle. And the Egyptians called them runners. All right, runners. And it looks like their job, and they were armed with a short sword and a helmet, and oftentimes they were foreign mercenaries, and particularly a group that the Egyptians called the Sherden, who were probably the ancestors of the Sardinians.
Huh.
The Sherden, who wore these funny little hats with little pointed tops. They look like my favorite Martian. I always think of these Sherden running around.
They were bringing them from Sardinia down into Egypt?
I don't think so. That's what a lot of scholars think. I have a heterodox view on this question. I think the Sherden go to Sardinia
later on
and take their name with them there.
Right.
I don't think they come from Sardinia. And I'll tell you why later. So anyway, these runners apparently were involved in dispatching enemy charioteers who have fallen out of their chariots or are wounded, saving your charioteers who have fallen out of their chariots or are wounded, dispatching enemy horses, etc. So what Robert Drews suggested is that essentially there was a hillbilly revolution. He doesn't use that term. That's my term. Okay. What he suggests is that people who lived in the mountains on the outskirts of these empires, think, for example, of Thrace and the northern Balkans. Think of the mountain ranges of Central Asia Minor. Now, people up in these mountain ranges, like all hillbillies, I can say this because I'm from Arkansas, one thing mountain people do is they come down into the bottomlands, right? And we shoot your stop signs if we're in Arkansas. But, you know, it's hard scrabble up there in the hills. It's hard to make a living, you know, and it's hard to grow your crops. And every once in a while, you want to go down in the bottomlands and make those people with the easy lives pay. What Drews suggests is that these hill people, these people on the outskirts of these empires, discovered something very important. And it was that they could use their short javelins to defeat chariot armies. How do you do this? Well, these in Greece, they called these little four or five foot javelins. It was called an aganae, which means basically something like goat spear. Okay, something you'd use to throw at goats when you're up in the hills. The advantage of this kind of spear is that you can carry several of them. Okay, and that the person wielding that spear is entirely mobile. He doesn't wear any or much, if any, defensive armor. And carries just a small round shield that has a central handle that the Greeks called an aspis, okay? It's basic little round shield. And you can move quickly and you can throw these spears. Well, the thing that's deadly about these spears for chariot armies is that you can take out the horses.
Right.
And once you take out the horses, a chariot is just a piece of wood laying on the ground. It's not a threat to anybody, right? Now, you've got to be willing to sustain casualties. Right? And one thing we know about hillbillies is they are willing to sustain casualties.
Right.
Because his chances, I'm either going to die or I'm going to win this battle or I'm going to have to go back up in the hills and live this hard life I'm living. So Drews hypothesizes that basically a revolution warfare occurred in which, and we don't know who did this first. Drews thinks it was the northern Greeks. Drews thinks it was the backward northern Greeks who lived in Thessaly, essentially in the area around there, who weren't like the more advanced southern Greeks, and that they began to raid at places like Troy. He would see Troy as one of the first cities taken down by these roving bands of marauders armed with goat's spears and using infantry against chariotry successfully.
Would Macedonia be included in that?
Yeah, that would be the area from Thessaly north, so modern Thessalia and Macedonia, Macedon and Thessaly, yeah. And whether it started there or not, Drews makes the case that once people saw this would work,
they started doing it.
Exactly. So you get a wave of javelin-armed infantrymen taking on chariot armies and winning at least enough to make it profitable to continue doing this, right?
Yeah.
And one of the breakthroughs that Drew's made in his research is that he looked at these long arrowheads that are found in this period. These are arrowheads that are, you know, 5 to 7 centimeters long. And I'm calling them arrowheads now, and that's what they had always been called. But Drew's looked at these points, these projectiles have something interesting about them. They don't have the, I want to use the word tang, but that's not the right word. They don't have the edges, the points in an arrow, which make it impossible to pull it out.
Like a barb almost. A barb, exactly.
Barbs, thank you. Right, but an arrow, you can't pull it out without doing more damage to yourself because of those barbs. But these points don't have those barbs. In other words, they're clearly meant to be withdrawn.
Right.
Used again, right? And Drew said, these are not arrowheads. These are not really big arrowheads. These are very small javelin points.
Javelin heads.
Now, another point interesting point that Drew's makes is, you know, you remember in the Old Testament when David is about to fight Goliath. Well, Goliath is a Philistine, all right? And as we're going to see, the Philistines are related to, if not directly related to, they're at least adjacent to these sea peoples, because that's what I'm describing now. I'm describing these marauders, all right, that the Egyptians are going to call the sea peoples. Goliath is described as a giant, of course, as everybody remembers, but he also has a special spear. Do you remember the description of his spear?
Yes, I do.
Well, it's said to be like unto a weaver's beam. That's the King James translation. He had a spear that was like unto a weaver's beam. Now, of course, as a kid, I always imagined a weaver's beam must be this big, giant thing because Goliath is a giant and he must have a huge spear. Well, what is a weaver's beam?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, Drew's hypothesis is that a weaver's beam is actually the shuttle that a weaver uses to make cloth. And the essential fact about it is that it is attached to a line. What Goliath's spear in being like unto a weaver's beam was because it was attached to a line. That is, it was rifled. It had a leather thong that was wrapped around the shaft of the spear so that when you threw it,
you could recall it.
Not that you could recall it, that you would actually cause it to spin.
I see.
Like a football does or a rifled bullet, right? And so it flies truer, straighter. It's a technological advancement. Now, we know those kinds of spears existed in antiquity. So this would explain the like unto a weaver's beam. It's not that it was really big. It was that it was this cool, you know, interesting kind of spear. Well, all right. So now that this is one of the most amazing things about this period. We know what this all looked like, okay? Because the Egyptians left pictures.
Oh, I see.
You know, we have these reliefs. Right. From the reign of Ramesses III, for example, around 1179, showing this mass number of infantrymen pouring into Egypt. And they came on ships, all right? Not all of them came on ships, but at least some of them came on ships. And so they're depicted. We know what kind of headdresses they wore. We know what kind of weapons they had. The Egyptians are depicted as with their composite bows, you know, and they're trying to take out these guys with their composite bows, but they're being overwhelmed by numbers, by people with an inferior technology,
but lots of them,
and they have this idea, which is that we can actually defeat these chariot army guys. So the Egyptians actually name these people. They call them the Peliset, the Tejeker, the Danyan, the Shekelesh, the Ekwesh, the Tertia. Those names almost all show up in later Near Eastern history. The Peliset are the Palestinians, all right, the Philistines. That's where Palestine gets its name, the Philistines. Right. The Tejeker, the Teucrians, there's a Trojans. The Danyan, the Naoi, the Greeks. One of the words for Greeks. Shekelesh, the Sicilians, all right, Sicilioi. The Ekwesh are almost certainly Akaiwoi, the Achaeans, another name for Greeks, another type of Greeks. And the Tertia, Etrurians, Etruscans, who show up, of course, in the Italian peninsula later.
Well, were these sea people? I mean, I know we don't know a lot about them, and people don't even know who they are, but what you're saying suggests an alliance and diplomacy among them. Like, hey, let's go loot Egypt.
an alliance of convenience.
Of convenience, yeah.
Which is exactly what the Homeric poems describe. Odysseus, in one of his lying bits, this is in Odyssey Book 9, pretends that he's one of these guys who left Crete and raided Egypt. And he describes this very kind of raid. And yes, that's precisely what I'm suggesting.
We're coming up on our second break. We'll be right back with the fall of archaic Greece. We're the historians.
Demoulas Supermarkets, under the trade name Market Basket, is a chain of 80 supermarkets in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Maine. Demoulas Supermarkets, Market Basket, more for your dollar.
Hi, this is Mike DeStacio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550. And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com. You can climb a mountain.
You can swim the sea. All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about the fall of Mycenaean Greece. Before we get back to that, Brendan, we have a very relevant historical sponsor today. You remember I believe it was our very first historical sponsor, Imperial Insurance of Rome.
How could I forget it? I shifted all my policies to them.
Right. Well, they've been back. You probably got the package. You got that bonus package, right? So correct. They're back again. And we're really happy to have back our longtime sponsor, Imperial Insurance of Rome. And they're once more offering a special product for our listener. Brendan, you know the three basic kinds of car insurance, right? There's liability, collision, and comprehensive. I'm sure you have all three types and probably even kinds of insurance because you're a very careful guy, very prudent guy.
Correct.
A lot of insurance, right? And of course, for our homes, you also have mortgage insurance or fire insurance, sometimes flood protection. You probably don't need it living up on the mountain there the way you do. But some of us even have umbrella policies that cover us in case of unforeseen circumstances, like a neighbor slipping on our icy steps or an attack by a rabid turkey, which I hope you have that rider on your policy.
I do now.
All right. But up until now, no insurance company has protected its policyholders from the really big problem, the so-called acts of God, or in this case, the gods. And that's why Imperial Insurance of Rome has created the Jupiter Optimus Maximus policy. This super premium policy covers the insured in cases of revolt, rebellion, civil war, all forms of plague, very important now, barbarian invasion, and this is the really important for today, complete social and economic collapse. Actually included in the policy. With the Jupiter Optimus Maximus policy, you are guaranteed to preserve your and your family's property, investments, and social standing through at least 5 centuries of cultural darkness. And of course, history teaches us that a dark age tends to last about 5 centuries, okay? The only thing not covered is language, which Imperial Insurance of Rome studies have shown cannot be preserved even in times of economic stability. And I think even a cursory reading of the New York Times or the Boston Globe will show that to be absolutely true. So if you're really worried about the future, opt for Optimus Maximus. And remember what Caesar said, divide and conquer, but first buy Imperial Insurance of Rome.
Imperial Insurance of Rome. Serving your needs for 2,100 years.
Man, that's amazing. Some of our sponsors have such amazing business models to have survived all these collapses.
Calamity, and yet they still go on.
Right. Well, one thing that don't seem to have had a lot of in this Eastern Mediterranean world around 1200 BC was insurance. They didn't have insurance against sea peoples showing up. Now, I've suggested that these peoples are, in fact, many of the groups that colonize the central and western Mediterranean. I think that they basically destroyed places like Ugarit. They sacked Troy. They sacked the Greek palaces. Many of the palaces in Greece sacked by these
This, so if these are the hill people, how are they getting ships to do all this stuff? Because you don't think of those hill people as having navies.
Right. Well, how do you get a ship when you don't have one?
You force the people, you conquer somebody who's got ships and then force them to sail them. I think that's
exactly it. And if you don't know how to sail it, you force someone to sail it for you. And, you know, this picture of Greek culture is reflected by Thucydides, the Athenian historian, who talks about the piracy in early Greece. And he says piracy was such a way of life in early Greece that people didn't even pretend they weren't pirates. That is, when you ran into somebody, you would say, "Hey, are you a pirate?" And it wasn't taken as an insult, right? No,
right.
Yeah, I'm a pirate. You know, that's my thing. I'm a pirate. You know, I could have been a welder or a bricklayer, but I'm a pirate.
Well, why now? I mean, all right, I get it. They just looting these cities because they want to loot them, basically.
That's right. They're available. They find out they can.
Right. They find out they can and that they don't have to, they can defeat their armies and loot them. And so they go and they loot a number of cities. And the more they loot, the more the sort of web of civilization you describe begins to break down.
Right. Because people that are in these cities undoubtedly oftentimes joined up. You know, that we need more people. We're going to the next big palace. You know, you guys join up and come on. There doesn't seem to have been any kind of ethnic or national theme here at all. It was just who wants to go along.
Who wants to do some looting?
And that's typical, you'd have to say, of pirate, you know, communities in general.
Multi-ethnic, multi-linguistic, yep. Multi-racial. It's,
yep.
You know.
Yeah. So, you know, you can see why the Egyptians can't describe these peoples as one group. You know, there's a bunch of different peoples that are involved. And I think that that some of these people, when they got through raiding, had enough stuff, you know, they took their stuff and they went to find new places to live. Interestingly, almost none of the palaces that were sacked in Greece seem to have ever been, re-inhabited in any kind of meaningful sense. I mean, Mycenae just was covered up with dirt.
Why?
Yeah, why? Is it? I mean, I hate this word taboo. It's one of the most bogus words. but it's possible, of course, that the people who lived around these places felt like that was a bad place, right? Bad stuff happened there, and we don't want to go back there.
Or something bad happened there, right? When it got sacked or whatever,
right?
It is.
Right. A lot of them had graves involved, and that may have something to do with it, too.
When they're excavated these sites, do they find the evidence of these sackings, the burning and the bodies and stuff?
Yeah. Not as much of it as you would hope. Troy, in the case of Troy, definitely. Ugarit, definitely. There are texts at some of these palaces that suggest, for example, at Pylos, they found a tablet, a Linear B tablet, that seems to suggest they were watching the coast, you know, to see what's coming.
How long did this period of looting and sacking go on?
Yeah, we can't really answer that question, but it seems to have started around the late 1200s and to be more or less over by the middle 1100s. So, you know, 50 to 100 years, something like that.
That'll really annihilate civilization. Exactly. Though, right? It'll annihilate it.
And even Egypt, Martin. Egypt's, none of the Hittite civilization completely collapses and disappears.
Right.
So much so that scholars who studied the Old Testament in the 19th century, when they read about the Hittites, you know, the Hittites are someone that the Israelites run up on all the time, you know, in the ancient Levant. The scholars who studied the Bible had no idea that there was a massive Hittite empire in Asia Minor. They thought that these Hittites were just local, you know, dudes you ran into when you were in, you know, the Levant. They didn't know anything about the Hittite empire until that Hattusis was discovered and those texts were read.
They were thinking the Hittites were just people hanging out on the corner, so to speak.
Yeah, of course, part of this has to do too with the fact that they hadn't the Rosetta Stone hadn't been deciphered yet. But once they could read Egyptian. And read the Akkadian, and those Hittite texts were discovered. Now, not only did they find out they existed, but they found out there were copies of letters between Egyptian kings, where we have a copy in the Egyptian archive and we have a copy in the Hittite archive.
Incredible.
We can compare. We have copies of treaties, a treaty in the Hittite archive, a treaty in the Egyptian archives. It's unbelievable, okay? But that world was gone. Egypt barely hung on, okay? Egypt wasn't destroyed. But it never recovers.
How did they hang on?
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, Egypt is a very unusual kind of place, right? You almost all the settlement is along the Nile,
right,
and in the Delta. All right. So maybe that has something to do with their ability to hang on. Their own account was that it was a harrowing period of invasion, but that they fought off these invaders who came by land and by sea. But how precisely they managed, but they were weakened in any case, very much weakened. And there's one other weapon I want to talk about here. My students in warfare and antiquity always kick out of this. I can't resist mentioning it. As infantry becomes more important and these chariot empires are trying to look for a way to defend themselves against these invaders, what they seize on is a better kind of sword, okay? And this is the moment when a type of sword that was developed apparently in Central Europe, well away from the Eastern Mediterranean, that scholars called a Nawa type 2 sword. Swords before this, before about 1200, swords were designed either as thrusting swords, in which case they needed to be short and broad, otherwise they'll bend, okay? There was no design of a sword that allowed it to be a thrusting sword and a slashing sword, okay? You had to have these, and the Egyptians used these kind of sickle-shaped swords that they used. The Nawa type 2 sword was the first modern sword, if I can use that term, in that it's about 70 to 90 centimeters in length, okay? So about a yard in length, a little shorter than a yard. And it's very broad, it's quite broad near the tip. It does come to a point, but then it's sort of leaf-shaped. It's fairly broad, and then it gets narrower towards the hilt. But the real advantage of the Nawa type 2 sword was that the hilt was a one piece of metal, and the blade and the hilt were one piece, okay? It had a tang, a long piece of metal from the blade that extended into the handle, and it was fixed onto a very substantial handle with rivets, okay? And what that means is that sword was capable of delivering decapitation power, all right, as well as thrusting power. And it actually had a kind of blood, what's called a blood channel in the center of the sword that took a little material out to kind of, I think it was essentially to lighten it, although a student once suggested to me that the purpose of the blood channel was to allow the air in the body cavity to escape when you, which may very well be.
There's a logic to that.
Right. You got to wonder about a student like that.
But, yes. Anyway,
no, it may very well be that. So all of a sudden, we see people scrambling to get these Nawa type 2 swords because they can use them against infantrymen. But of course, as soon as they're out there, the sea peoples are going to get their hands on them too, right?
Right.
So, you know, pretty quickly you get this arms race and everybody's armed with Nawa type 2 swords.
So the sea people continue to raid, and there's a sort of prolonged period of basically their whole goal is just to sack every town from that earlier period that had developed a substantial trade and wealth and palaces, and they're sacking them. And what kind of and they don't reoccupy the spots of these cities or palaces. How do they live and where do they live?
Well, I think they go. And this is where the Pelleset come into play again. Who were the Philistines? The Philistines of the Bible, of the Old Testament, were invaders who occupied the territory along the coast of the Levant and become a big problem for the Israelites, right? They're the main enemies of ancient Israel in the Old Testament. Well, the Philistine sites have been excavated, and you know what they look like? They look like Mycenaean Greeks.
Oh.
They have the same pottery. They have the same, you know, they're basically their physical culture. Now, it's not exactly the same, all right? It's very, very similar. So there are scholars who think that the Philistines were Mycenaean Greeks. And there are scholars who think, no, they're just part of this nexus, right? This world of sea peoples. They're all adjacent cultures.
And they either adopted Mycenaean ways or they stole stuff from the Mycenaeans, right?
Well, there were a few Mycenaeans with them.
With them.
Some Mycenaean women. Maybe Mycenaean men with Pelleset women, right? We've got a mixed bag going on here. I think some of them went to Sardinia and became the Sherdin, went to Sardinia and gave that place their name. The Shekelesh went to Sicily and gave it their name. The Tertia went to northern Italy and gave Etruria its name. And so you see that the story that the Romans told about their past, which was, where did they say they came from? Troy.
The East, right? The East.
Right. Aeneas is a refugee who is in this world of this mixed up destruction, and he ends up where? In Egypt, after he lands in North Africa. I mean, not in Egypt, in Italy.
In Italy.
And, right. So, you know, this kind of forms a coherent a story, I think. But for the people who lived through it, it was a nightmare. Where
hell on earth.
Hell on earth. And what we also see in this period is people moving away from the coast, is that settlements that have been founded on the coast move inland because they're afraid of the pirates.
Right. Into defensive positions.
Yeah, exactly.
We are up on our final break. We'll be right back with the historians.
There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee, available at your local supermarket.
All right, we're back with the historians. For information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com. Well, I thought we were going to get into the period after the collapse today, the Dark Age, but, you know, we had the collapse itself was so interesting.
So many places were being looted and burned with new style swords that let the air out of their victims.
Yes, I've often used, you know, the fact that the javelins they used could be rethrown, that you would go and pull the javelin out of your enemy. I've often used this as the example from my own life that I've used to explain this to my students is why a wet green pine cone is the best possible projectile for a young Arkansan. Our favorite projectile were the hard dirt clods filled with rocks. Because those are very satisfying when they hit their target because they explode. Of course, they leave a cloud of dust. But the problem is that, you know, you can't retrieve it. And it has an advantage in that it can't be thrown back at you. You know, the green wet pine cone, right, are heavy. And they have the nice pricklies on them. So they leave a nice mark on the forehead, you know, when you hit somebody with one. Now, they can be thrown back. So there's a problem there.
I'm glad to see your youth wasn't misspent.
You telling me you didn't have little wars and battles when you were
a kid? Oh yeah.
So anyway, we like to stock up those dirt clods and those pine cones for our battles. Anyway, as I said, I can talk about hillbillies. All right, I'm allowed. That's not cultural appropriation in my case.
We're gonna come back and we're gonna be talking about how archaic Greece falls into a dark age. In our next episode, but right now we're turning to our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News, my favorite segment.
Well, you'll be happy to learn there's only one obituary this
week.
Wow.
Yes. Oh, okay, that's great, I guess.
Yeah, I almost didn't do any obituaries.
Well, I thought that couldn't would be have too, that, yeah, though.
Wrong. John Richards has died. Do you know who he was?
Our fellow graduate student at Brown?
No, he did not have that name. No, I hope not. No. Okay. He was the English journalist who basically made almost a career out of defending and defining the proper use of the apostrophe. Do you remember that? the apostrophe, which he's right. It's under assault in the English language because of texting and everything else. It's under assault. And he had founded the Apostrophe Protection Society in 2001. He died. He was almost 100 years old because he was fighting the good fight. He was 98 years old.
Grammar gives life.
Issue 2, and moving away rapidly out of the obituary section, I would note the change of leadership at Berkshire Hathaway. Of course, as many of your listeners will know, Warren Buffett has been the head of Berkshire Hathaway basically forever, and Charlie Munger is his partner, sort of his advisor. He's the number two. One is 90, the other is 97. They're still full of fight, but they basically have gone out and said, look, if one of us dies, particularly if Warren dies, this person is going to take over. And of course, Warren Buffett has been a huge force in American economic culture, so to speak, over the last 40, 50 years. I mean, he's 90 and the other fellow's 97, but they have finally named successors to themselves in a way. But
like ancient emperors.
Yeah, I would note that they were discussing Bitcoin at their last meeting, and they both said, "Yeah, I don't get understand that. I don't get what that's about. And if it's true, you know, if it becomes real, it's very destructive, and it seems like a speculative thing. I don't understand Bitcoin either. So that may be me. I take it very seriously, but I don't understand it."
Well, in a world where the only thing that provides actual value for the fiat currencies of the Western world is faith in that government or economy. The
right.
idea of a currency which is based simply on other people's deeming it valuable, if people will trade in it, it has value.
It makes sense in a certain yes. level. Yes, it does. And it's outside government control, and it's related to the tech world, which has a sort of internationalist approach to many things. So
yep.
it is, but there's a whole issues about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, which I'd like to talk about more in a future episode. For the Daily News, Amtrak turns 50. Amtrak, the train.
Did anybody notice?
The government, Joe Biden, he loves Amtrak. President Biden loves Amtrak, and he came out and spoke about Amtrak and put an Amtrak hat on.
He probably thinks it's still a viable entity.
I remember the period right before Amtrak was formed. I remember those older train lines, you know, the private companies that ran that, but just vaguely. But they came into Newark, New Jersey, those trains from the other company, and I do remember something about that. On a more serious sort of note here, I hope our listener or listeners is following what's going on with the French military, who have been several groups of retired officers and now sort of larger groups of both retired and active officers have been issuing public proclamations saying France is headed to some kind of internal convulsion over the issue of Islamic migration to France and the Islamic cultures in France. This has become tied up in the electoral power struggle that is now emerging in France between President Macron and Marine Le Pen, the leader of the sort of ultra-right group in France. And it has become caught up in the whole sort of struggle, which is very serious. Le Pen is leading Macron in some polls, or close to leading him in some polls, and it's a very serious issue. But people are saying, oh, there couldn't be a military coup in France. Of course, there were efforts at military coups in France in, I believe, 1959 and 1961. And there was an attempted coup in Spain in 1981 or 82.
Coup in Greece in 1967, which was successful and lasted until 1974.
Right. And the thing about that is that it's not like it can't happen if the situation deteriorates and people feel like their order is undermined, and it speaks to today's episode. Order is so undermined that it's not, you know, viable. That people understandably value order. They yep. value their lives. Yep. But this issue with France, I don't think that's going away. It's come tied up with the French military, with the struggle between Macron, who's in the center, and Le Pen, who's too far to the right, you know, far to the right to him. I think it's entirely possible Le Pen is going to be elected.
Well, nationalism and immigration are universal issues in the West at this
right.
point.
Right. Yeah. And trying to deny them or to talk around them, it no longer works. It worked 30 years ago, but it does not work now. You've got to have a policy, and you have to have a position. And some of these politicians don't want to take a position.
Yeah.
I did want to point people, of course, we do our East African app updates. There's two things going on in East Africa that really we need to have our attention on. One is that in Tigray, in the state that's in revolt in Ethiopia, which we've talked about in the earlier episodes, it borders on Eritrea to the north. There is what one person calls an anti-farming campaign. In other words, they are not letting these Tigrayan farmers plant their fields, which is what caused the famous famine in Ethiopia in the 1980s. It's seen, as you know, wow. This has gone on since, you know, it happened during World War II in spots. People burn the crops of their enemies in order to drive them off the land. That's happening in Tigray right now. And of course, it'll lead to a famine if it's not curtailed by the world community.
The ancient Greeks did the same thing, but they did it primarily to provoke you to come out and fight. You know, we're going to be burning your farmlands. What are you going to do? You're going to just let us do it? You're going to come out and fight?
Or we'll cut down your olive trees
yeah,
and come out. And in this instance, and what's happening in Tigray, I think it's a way of trying, because they've several guerrilla movements are fighting. There's one sort of umbrella movement is fighting both the central government and the Eritreans. It's a way of trying to drive them out of their rural, you know, strongholds, drive them out of the land, so to speak, and force them either into combat or to flee the country or to put their weapons down. While this has been going on, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church has blasted what's happening in Tigray as a genocide or an attempted genocide, which is really unusual for that church to take a political position against the government, essentially. In part, I think this is related to the intervention of the Eritreans, many of whom are Muslim, into the conflict in Tigray. But there's a very strong denunciation. I would also call our listeners' attention to the intense diplomatic conversations going on in the Nile Valley from basically south of Ethiopia all the way up to Egypt and into other areas over this dam and this water issue. There is intense diplomatic. Of course, Sudan is having a dispute with Ethiopia over borders as well, fertile farmland along a border. But there is a lot of diplomatic activity. The Biden administration, to their credit, is trying to keep it from becoming a shooting situation, and have sent diplomats to try to sort of get everyone talking in a kind of civil way, restore talks. But that the Ethiopian damming of the Nile is really driving, and I think it's entirely possible that will become a kinetic war. It's entirely the diplomacy among the African states is intense, far more intense than it's being reported in the American press. They are going back and forth. You know, people are visiting. The Eritreans are sending people to Sudan. Sudan there are people from Sudan going to speak to Egypt. Egypt speaking to the people in Sudan. It really has become a kind of giant crisis. It's an ongoing and sort of intensifying crisis, because there's no way to really the Ethiopians want that dam, and the people in the other places are like, this dam threatens us.
Is the Arab world involved in trying to keep that area stable? I mean, are they diplomatically involved, or are they just playing hands off, you know?
I don't know. And of course, there is, you know, a kind of cleavage line there between states there that are Muslim and states that are Christian and non-Muslim. I don't know what their situation is. Two things about Northern Ireland have come up. One is from the Wall Street Journal from May 12th on page A9. 10 killed by army in 1971 found innocent. They investigated 10 people who were murdered, apparently murdered or killed accidentally or murdered. It's unclear. The article is not clear. As the Northern Ireland really began that descent into 1971 and 72 with that intense violence, these were 10 civilians. They weren't involved. They were either killed by accident, or they were killed by the army, you know, who thought they were guerrillas, or they were killed, you know, it was an atrocity of some kind. It may have been an accident. I don't want to indict these guys. I don't know what the exact course of it is. It's a brief piece, and I don't know what the episode that they're talking about in here was. Two of the people killed, a mother of eight, a Catholic priest, and a World War II veteran. They shot them. Yeah, again, it goes back to our talk on that. There was also in the Financial Times, excellent in their weekend, May 8th, May 9th, their weekend edition, a long and excellent piece about the history of the dividing line in Northern Ireland. I recommend it to people. You can still get it online. May 8th, May 9th, Financial Times. It's a two-page treatment of it. Excellent, thorough job compared to, say, what the Boston Globe published when on this issue. No offense, but I'm really angry about that Boston Globe piece. U.S. pulling out of Afghanistan after a 20-year war. I don't think there's any question in my mind that the Taliban will be in charge again in a matter of months, that the U.S., you know, maybe at least in most of the country, not in the north, which they've never been able to conquer. Separate different ethnic groups are involved in the north, different religious people with different religious affiliations. But if the only way the country, in quotes, can be stable is if a U.S. Praetorian Guard stays in Kabul, it's not a country, you know, or, you know, the government can't hold on that basis unless we're going to occupy Afghanistan forever, which has become a debate. But it's now the 20th year of that occupation. It's one of the longest wars in American history. The longest. I did want to call people's attention. I've been meaning to do this, but we're up on time. So I want to go into the end of the Castro family as the dominant group in Cuba, which has now come. For whatever reason, they are no longer, that family, they didn't try to pass on their authority. But we're now coming up on the end of the show. I did want to call people's quick attention to on this final piece, a piece that was from April 11th. There are now people in Israel. They've an Israeli team has been excavating caves of people, primitive peoples, and they think that the people who drew those cave paintings that everyone always talk about as being so spectacular with the animals running and stuff, they think that they were basically depriving themselves of oxygen to get high while they were painting them. There's this whole crazy thing about it. It's absolutely fascinating. But we're up on our end of our time, so we can't go that much more deeply into it, which I somehow think is a good thing.
If you say
we are at the end of our time. We're coming back next week. We're the historians.
Thank you.